Welcome to Carittles. This is Wendy.
And this is Amanda.
Today's cast, Data Analysis for Beginners, Avoid Common Mistakes, Part 2.
The questions that this cast answers are, what should I watch out for when analyzing data? What's wrong with my data? And what alternatives to data are there?
If you want the answers to these questions and more, keep listening.
June 24th at 10 a.m. Eastern, we're hosting an online ECC, and we'd love to invite you. By the end of the session, you'll be able to watch another person for 2 or 3 minutes, identify their DISC profile, and tailor your communications to them. And it's an insanely effective way to communicate and help your team reach their goals. June 24th over Zoom, virtual effective communicator conference starting at 10 a.m. Eastern. Sign up at manager-tools.com/training.
Last week, we started this podcast about data analysis for beginners or for people that don't do that very often, or if you're starting a new data set, potentially, we've got some high-level things for you to think about. We talked about checking with reality and making sure that your data reflects the reality you live in, looking for the assumptions that were made, that you're making now and that were made when the data was collected, and also that the data is quality data. And this week, we're going to talk about bias and when not to use data. So bias is a distortion of a result caused by, a lot of the time, our own human ways of thinking. If I ask you, when was the last time you ate fast food? It's really easy to remember. If I ask you, how often do you eat fast food? I bet you'll say like, oh, twice a year. Like, because those are the only two times you can remember. But if you go through your bank statements, there's more. It's because we don't remember everything. We remember the most recent things. We don't remember things we don't want to remember, like going to fast food restaurants. There's all sorts of things in our thinking as human beings that cause us not to see reality as it really is. And we can take that into the data. So that's what bias is.
And there are numerous well-known biases that humans are prone to. And fortunately for us, Wikipedia has a whole list for you. However, we're just going to go over a few. So here are some common ones to watch out for. First, look out for selection bias. Are you introducing errors into your analysis by the choice of the data that you're using? So for example, if you're looking at customer satisfaction and you only select customers who purchased at the high end of your product range, your customer satisfaction rates could well be artificially inflated, especially when sales reps are paid on commission because they have a real good reason to be a lot nicer to you. Increase satisfaction scores, right? If they're going to spend money at your place of business, people tend to be nicer, so the satisfaction scores tend to be higher.
Yeah. So if you actually wanted real or unbiased customer satisfaction scores, you'd have to look at the entire product range to see something more normal. Or you might want to actually break up and look at customer satisfaction by product so that you get something more accurate. And selection bias can be quite subtle. So for example, if you choose to survey all your customers about the satisfaction, say you do have a product range and you have those high spenders and you think, okay, I can't ask just those people because I know that's a bias. So I'll ask everybody, I'll send them an email and send them a survey and see if they were satisfied. Well, then the results that come back are only those people who reply to your survey. So say you send it out to 10,000 people and you get 2,000 answers, you know the customer satisfaction rate for 2,000 people, but you don't know the customer satisfaction rate for the other 80% of your customers. And maybe that's all you can get and you have to use that data, but knowing that is affecting your results is really important for the actions that you decide to do next. And sometimes people will reply to those kind of customer satisfaction things if they're very happy or very angry, very unsatisfied. So you miss a whole bunch of people in the middle. It's like if you look at reviews on Amazon, for example, apart from the ones that aren't real, there's the 5 stars and the 1 stars. And there isn't a whole bunch in the middle because the people in the middle just got their thing and were like, yeah, it's fine. Had nothing to say. And so they didn't put anything on Amazon. They didn't go do the review. So when you're looking at that data, you have to take that customer behavior into account.
Another bias to check for is the sample size. Selection bias often occurs in tandem with the sample size errors, just like Wendy was talking about, depending on who you're sampling. So at a hospital, they might decide to evaluate a new treatment protocol by implementing it in only their specialized cardiac unit, which has the more experienced staff. While this approach might seem logical, if the cardiac unit represents just 5% of all patient care, the results can't be extrapolated to predict success across all departments. So if you are sampling a small sample size, you cannot generalize that result because you're biased towards a very small percentage of your folks.
And if you think about it, if you were in a hospital and you just implemented this new regime in a cardiac unit where the nurses are specialized and there's probably more resources per patient, the patient demographics might be different to the rest of the hospital. So it's not only that it's a small number compared with the rest of the people that are in your hospital, it's also that those people have a different kind of care than the rest of the hospital. I bet if you look at success rates in ICU versus the rest of the hospital, those are completely different because in ICU, there's so much intensive care. That's why they call it that, right? But, you know, there's always a really high medical personnel to patient ratio that there isn't in the rest of the hospital. So knowing that, you have to be careful about what data you're comparing.
And then another bias to look for is confirmation bias. Our favorite data is the data that agrees with our hypothesis, because we were right.
Hey.
However, this is not always because we are super smart, but because we look for the data that agrees with us. For the Effective Communicator Conference, we practice observing different behaviors. And inevitably, as soon as someone figures out what DISC profile I'm acting out, that it skews all their data because somehow I have no behaviors on the other side. I'm like, okay, so let's all talk about confirmation bias. Just because you think you have the answer, don't neglect everything else to make you seem right.
Humans are complex beings. We don't have, if you know what the DISC profile is, and if you don't, we have a million podcasts about it. We don't have only high D behaviors. If you saw me before coffee in the morning, you would think I was reserved. I'm not, but it's before coffee me. So, you know, there's no way that even if you're acting out a profile, there's only one set of behaviors. It reminds me of my dad, who is convinced that putting the own brand, like the supermarket label coffee, into the coffee jar that says the brand on it, that my mom can't tell. And the answer is my mom can't tell because he doesn't tell her and she can't tell. She's convinced that the coffee that's coming out of the jar that has the label on of the brand that she likes is that coffee, whether it is or not. And it's just confirmation bias. She sees the jar, she sees the label, and therefore it must be that coffee. It tastes great. And it doesn't matter. It's just confirmation bias. It doesn't matter. It wouldn't matter what coffee was in there. Her brain is telling her it's in that jar. It must taste good.
It's like the water at Disney World definitely tastes better than the water right outside the gate. Even if it's like the same type of bottled water, it just tastes better because it costs a lot more.
Right. We have all sorts of weird things that we convince ourselves of that don't matter 100% of the time. But if you're looking at data then and you're trying to draw conclusions and you're going to use resources on those conclusions, you need to at least be aware of the things that you're saying in your own mind.
Yeah, and this also happens in the workplace. Imagine a marketing director who firmly believes that email campaigns are more effective than social media advertising. When reviewing campaign performance data, they might highlight the few email campaigns that outperformed social media, while dismissing the numerous cases where social media delivered better results. They might even attribute social media successes to unusual circumstances while treating email successes as proof of the superior channel. Because if they want it one way, that's how we present the data or that's how we perceive the data. So there's going to be those biases. They happen, I mean, more than we'd like to probably admit.
Yeah.
But something to be aware of and tease out early.
And that's a good use of ChatGPT. I'm looking at data for X. What biases might there be in there? Or what biases might I not be thinking about? I love the fact that ChatGPT is entirely logical.
New to your career and not sure where to turn for guidance? We empower professionals like you to take charge of their career. Over the last 35 years, we've gathered data on behaviors and outcomes over 600,000 managers and professionals, and we can help you too. We're committed to providing tools and resources, fostering consistent career growth, no matter how busy your schedule or how tight your budget. Learn more about how we can help you at manager-tools.com/memberships.
Okay, last one of these biases. And like we said, there are hundreds of them. So go down the list from Wikipedia or anywhere else if you think that there might be something else that you're missing, or try and find the ones that might particularly apply to data. Ask ChatGPT what ones might particularly apply to the data, because otherwise these podcasts would be hundreds of hours long and you didn't want that. So the last big one is outlier bias. And this occurs in the data rather than our thinking usually. So if you're looking at sales data for most products, there will be a cluster of customers who spend the average amount on the product. So if we think about everybody who went to the grocery store today, there's an average amount that they all sent on cereal, like $10, say. But there is one or two customers who went into the grocery store today and have 50 children at a summer camp at the weekend, and they spent hundreds of dollars on cereal. And if you look at that data and then you average it, you're going to be way off on what the average sale of cereal is. You have to be really careful about including people from the very top end of the scale and the very bottom end of the scale, because they skew the average.
And just for an example, for all of those people that love to math, if 9 customers spend $100 each and 1 customer spends $1,000, the average purchase value will appear to be $190. That's nearly doubled what most customers actually spent. This misleading average might cause you to make pricing or inventory decisions that don't align with the behavior of your typical customer, because your typical customer is only spending around $100. So increasing the price isn't going to be a smart move based on your one outlier, right?
And we talked about check with reality right at the beginning and cross-referencing your metrics. If we talk about that cereal data, if Amanda is my general manager of my grocery store and I'm running cereal, and I go to her and I say, yeah, the average sale of cereal this weekend was $200. We should buy more cereal. And Amanda goes to whoever does the accounting and says, show me the row for cereal. And that number isn't significantly higher than I think it should be from, you know, weeks prior, then there's something wrong with my data, which there is, right? There should be a corresponding amount of revenue for cereal as there are customers buying cereal at the rate at which I'm saying it's true. So being able to cross-reference data is where you can find some of those errors if you've made them.
Just a fun reminder that's easily forgotten from our high school math: you can't average averages. Directly averaging a set of averages, therefore without accounting for the size of each group, typically produces incorrect results. This happens because simple averages don't account for the different sizes of the groups being averaged.
And Excel does not tell you that when you have a list of averages and then you write equals AVG and you just average that column. It won't tell you that, but your data's wrong. So the last pitfall that we could fall into is mixing causation and correlation. So causation obviously means one thing caused another. Correlation means two things that happened look related. So for example, you might notice that when your child wears their favorite superhero pajamas to bed, they tend to sleep through the night without waking up. So that's a correlation. Two things happen at the same time. They're wearing the special pajamas and they're sleeping through the night. And you might think, I'm going to get more of those special pajamas because this kid sleeps through the night when they're wearing their special pajamas.
However, it could be that your child only wears those pajamas after bath nights, which follow days with more physical activity and outdoor play. It's actually the increased physical activity that's causing the better sleep and probably a nice bath time than not specifically the pajamas.
So the answer is take your kid out to play and wear them out more, not yes. Buy more pajamas. So
just saved you money.
Yes, exactly. Right? So there's a famous example of this. I don't know when it's from the 80s, I think, where there is a graph that plots the per capita consumption of margarine and the divorce rate in Maine. And the two lines are so close together that it can be assumed that buying margarine causes you to get divorced if you live in Maine. Those two graph lines look exactly the same. And obviously, it's not true. It's not like everybody in Maine should go buy butter because otherwise they get divorced. It looks like that because the lines are so similar. And it's complete coincidence. You know, if you think about it, margarine was invented in the 50s, 60s. And so we've increased our consumption of margarine at the same time as divorce has become more acceptable. So, of course, the two lines look similar. So if you have a graph where two lines look really similar and you're thinking, oh, look, those two things are correlated, go back and think, is it really true that those two things are correlated, or could it be coincidence? Does it make sense?
What we're saying is look for relationships, not those coincidences. Anytime that there appears to be a simple explanation, dig more. The real world is complex, and the simple explanations should be viewed with some suspicion.
Okay, and the last one is avoid using data when. So even though at the beginning of this, we said making data-driven decisions is so much better than being driven by gut feel or intuition or all of the other things that you could use, there are times when data or more data isn't helpful for making decisions. And more data isn't always helpful. Sometimes it just muddies the water, making the decision even more difficult. And we make consequential decisions all the time with insufficient data because it just isn't the ability to take into account every single factor or to test every eventuality. Most of us will buy a home with a 25-year mortgage, assuming that we're going to be able to pay it for those 25 years. And we have no idea what will come to us in the next 2 years, let alone 25. And we have to limit the amount of information we use, the amount of data that we use to make the decision about buying a house, because otherwise we'd be completely overwhelmed and unable to make a decision. And the same is true in business. You can't take into account every single factor. And often it's about making a decision at the right time as it is about having all the data and being comprehensive. Sometimes you just have to go with what we have as the decision-making process or what we have as data because we can't get all of it, or we have to make a decision now in order to, you know, it's no use waiting and waiting and waiting to decide what to have in stock for Christmas because Christmas is going to come at some stage. You can't just keep waiting until you have perfect data. You have to give yourself a cutoff date.
And in some circumstances, we don't need more numbers. We need qualitative data. A focus group is a market research method that brings together about 6 to 10 people in a room to provide feedback regarding a product, service, concept, or marketing campaign. They are popular because customer opinions don't always fit into a Likert scale of I completely agree or I completely disagree. This is the data analysis equivalent of don't send another email, just go talk to them. Using those focus groups, getting that actual verbal feedback can be more helpful than just collecting more data numbers because we get that insider information that 1 through 5 won't tell you.
Mm-hmm. And sometimes you're making assumptions about the way customers treat what you're buying. A lot of the time when we're developing things for manager tools, I think I have the best idea in the world. And then when we put it out, I like orange and the whole world likes green, and I have no idea why, but they do. And I'm not the sample customer. And so my opinion isn't right. And sometimes you have to go out and ask the customers directly, do you like green? And gathering data is also expensive. It takes time and labor to work out when it should be collected, how, by whom. It takes time and labor to collect it and store it and analyze it. And sometimes the best approach is to trust your experience, or to make a decision with the information you already have, or run a quick experiment to see what direction you should go in without making a whole bunch more effort. That minimum viable product idea that started with software engineering of like, just get something out there and see how people react is sometimes the right thing to do.
Now, we've only scratched the surface of the data literacy in this podcast. There are entire fields of study dedicated to statistics, data science, and research methodology that go much deeper than this. But by being aware of these common pitfalls, you're already better equipped to use the data effectively. So use these practical strategies to help you build your reputation as someone who uses data thoughtfully and makes better decisions as a result.
Thanks, Amanda.
Thanks, Wendy.
Good luck with your data, everybody. Join us next week as we cover a new topic. Bye.
Bye.